You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Spring 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of the cover story, Dream Big, by Nate Freeman, with photographs by Mert Alas. What does it mean for someone who's been in the public eye since she was 10 years old to be having a moment? For Kylie, who's been famous for beyond her entire adult life, it's walking into a movie theater and seeing herself. When we met on a sunny January day, a New Yorker's dream of Los Angeles in winter, the Hollywood premiere of the moment, Charlie XCX's bizarro brat summer mockumentary, where Kylie makes a brief but memorable cameo, was 2 days away. The first movie premiere that I'm in, I'm thrilled. I'm really thrilled, she says. This is the most excited I've been for the red carpet. Usually I'm not. She trails off for a second. I feel like there's so much pressure, but I'm so excited to be there. It was a career move that shocked some of the people around her. Her social media panopticon is already in so many ways bigger than the 600 movie theaters that an independent film might play in. I remember Kylie mentioning that she was interested in acting, and I wasn't sure if she was being totally serious or not, says Aidan Zamiri, the director of the moment, and a friend of Kylie's, who also works with her boyfriend, the actor Timothy Chalamet, on some of his viral social media spots. Her expressing interest in being in our film, that's crazy. Her role speaks to where Kylie is in 2026, what her relationship to the culture has become. She's playing an over-the-top version of the incredibly famous Kylie Jenner, who, while relaxing at a high-end spa in Ibiza, bumps into an over-the-top version of the hard-partying pop star Charlie XCX, who is in a debilitating funk. She doesn't know if she can maintain the whole brat thing, and is convinced she'll eventually lose all relevancy, the thing she's fought so hard to achieve. And without a shred of self-doubt, the most relevant woman on earth issues this soul-crushing diktat to Charlie. The second you think people are getting sick of you, that's when you have to go even harder. It struck me as soon as I saw it, oh, Kylie gets it. In fact, she came up with the entire scene herself. I kind of presented the idea actually to Aidan as a joke, Kylie says. I was like, well, if you want me to be in it, I would love to. I felt like it was a comfortable avenue for me because I knew him, I know Charlie, and I felt like for my first thing, this would be the perfect fit. They came back, and Charlie was really excited. And they legitimately wrote me into the script, and I was like, oh shit, now I have to do it. There's no doubt that reportedly cohabitating with the most in-demand silver screen icon since Leonardo DiCaprio has upped Kylie's letterboxed game. I've actually gotten a few scripts. Nothing that I feel is right yet, but I 100% want to do more, she tells me. I really like comedy. I think I'm good at it. She pauses. Maybe next time I talk to you, I'll be the lead of an action movie. So who's her dream director after working with Zamiri? I'm a fan of so many amazing directors, but I don't know. Maybe I need to dream bigger or something, she says. Dream big, I say, repeating the slogan of a recent Oscar contender. In the last years of my 20s, I want to focus on just me, my businesses, my work, traveling with my kids, enjoying my kids, and then, she says coyly, I do want to have more kids. Back in January, Kylie had invited me over to her house, a 15,000-square-foot mansion on the most exclusive street in the best nook of Los Angeles, a storied micro-neighborhood of homes that have put up movie stars for a century. It was always going to be a paraglide into the uncanny valley when meeting Kylie in person. there was a sort of cognitive dissonance at play. The fact that she's turned being genuine on the internet into a full-time job, that didn't fully dawn on me until I was standing in front of these gigantic castle doors, past the even more imposing 20-foot gates with a security detail, and suddenly when they opened, there she was, smiling, ready to hang. Kylie walked me past the foyer, which had a series of matte black fire features. The agora filled floor to ceiling with art and fashion books, and the basketball pickleball courts before we settled into the massive open-air space for entertaining. The artist James Turrell's work is installed in the poolside cabanas, and there is a palm tree in the middle of the courtyard. I wanted to get into what, apart from movie magic, she sees as the next stage of the Kylie factory, how she's expanding the beauty and fashion brands that made her rich, and how she's leveraging her social media kingmaker status to build a pan-cultural fiefdom. But before all that, I wanted to know more about her relationship with Chalmay. Despite the couple's years-long efforts to lie low, something seems to have shifted recently. In December, Chalmay hopped on a track with SD Kid, and nestled in his bars is a pretty clear nod to Kylie. Is Timothy Chalmay chillin', trying to stack 100 million? Girl got a billion? What the F? What a wonderful feeling. And in return, perhaps the most consistently visible she's been off-screen in years, Kylie has been working the awards circuit, accompanying her boyfriend as he goes for Oscar gold in his role in Josh Safdie's Marty Supreme. A few days prior to our interview, Chalmay won the Critics' Choice Award for Best Actor and thanked his partner of 3 years. Thank you for our foundation. I love you. I couldn't do this without you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, he said, from the stage directly to Kylie, who seemed to melt at the recognition of what was going on before mouthing back, I love you. Is it fun to be shouted out on stage, I ask? It's the only time in our interview that Kylie gets flustered, but in the most charming way possible, she gets legitimately heart-fluttery, shy about how to truly answer. She wasn't expecting any direct questions about the relationship. But hadn't he gone in front of the damn Critics' Choice Awards and told her he loved her? Hadn't she posted his Golden Globe statuette in a carousel of after-party pics to Instagram, and as such to the whole world? It was a far cry from the years of tabloids, reporting every sighting of them together and tracking the couple's efforts to maintain a level of absolute secrecy. Is it fun? Of course, she says, blushing. Their relationship has the general public whipped into a frenzy. How can he be with her? How can she be with him? Maybe that's because, despite the fact that they are two of the most famous people of their generation, Chalamet's in the midst of a nonstop multi-platform charm offensive of an Oscars campaign, and suddenly it's apparent that we kind of don't know all that much about Kylie. She spent her life in the spotlight, avoiding performative in real life gestures. Because we all collectively first met Kylie as a 9-year-old on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and forever think of her as the littlest of the principal kids, she's the product of a time warp, an optical illusion of watching someone age in real time on a TV show that's supposed to be reality. But the question has always been, what goes down on the other side of the screen? If you type, how did Kylie, into Google, it auto-populates a simulation of our collective imagination, a look into the id of the Kylie fan. How did Kylie Jenner get famous? How did Kylie Jenner make her money? How did Kylie Jenner change her face? How did Kylie Jenner get rich? In search of answers, I started with the visionary behind much of the Kardashian world. I say this about all my kids, but Kylie is one of the kindest, most generous young ladies I've ever met, says Momager Chris. What makes this all the more remarkable, even coming from her mother, is the hoops she had to jump through to cultivate a cool girl persona while growing up in an unprecedented context. Next photo, the main choice. Kylie, of course, is not a model, but she can nonetheless shift global markets just by wearing a dress. She was raised by a family that built a multi-billion-dollar media and apparel business, not despite their world historical dysfunction, but on the back of it. Let me present you with a hyper-condensed history of 2 decades of on-camera Kardashian drama. Kim's marriage got annulled after 72 days. Khloe's then-husband, Lamar Odom, spiraled into drug abuse, was found unconscious at a Nevada brothel called Love Ranch, and suffered 12 strokes and 6 heart attacks while in an extended coma. Kylie's partner, Tyga, previously had a kid with Blac Chyna, who went on to have another baby with her half-brother, Rob Kardashian. Kim threatened to fire Kourtney for hiding her personal life, and Kourtney slapped Kim in the face. After coming out as a transgender woman, Caitlyn Jenner revealed her new name on the cover of this magazine. Kendall's Pepsi commercial, where she leaves a fashion shoot to join a protest and gives a can of soda to a police officer, was pulled from the air after widespread condemnation. Kim got robbed at gunpoint in Paris. Khloe's partner, Tristan Thompson, was caught cheating on her with Jordan Woods, who was at the time Kylie's best friend. And then there was the Kanye West of it all. And yet Kylie has emerged as shockingly, almost disconcertingly normal, even though she started as an unwitting participant on the cable show on E!, she was also a famous young person during the first wave of social media, the test case for a generation that embraced the power of being on screen. She's a Leo, so she was the entertainer of our duo, Kendall tells me. There was a self-imposed Truman Show going on. Keeping Up with the Kardashians didn't film at her school, so she duly documented being a teenager all by herself, turning her upbringing into an extension of the cable TV content. I don't think any of us knew what we were getting ourselves into in the beginning, Kylie tells me. I was 9. I have a daughter now who's turning 8, so it's crazy to see her and how young she is. And this is when you start creating your first memories. It's almost like I just don't know anything else. I never got a taste of normalcy as an adult. Growing up in it almost was a benefit to me because I don't have anything to compare it to, really. 18 years later, she still knows exactly what she's doing. It turns out Kylie has a Warholian grasp on how fame operates, and a new media savant's understanding of how images disseminate into the world. And like Warhol said, making money is art, and working is art, and good business is the best art. Every aspect of her business exactingly reflects her own taste, which was forged in the fire of dialogue on Instagram comments. One could argue she's not just an artist, but the first one to make a fortune off the like economy. To use an art world framing, what makes Kylie's image-based practice so indelible, so addictive, is the way she inhabits that fuzzy gray area between fact and fiction. Her enormous popularity stems from the fact that Kylie-ness is theoretically just as accessible as lipstick. But she's also a fictionalized version of that aesthetic, one that exaggerates reality. The bombshell, the billionaire, the starlet with a movie star boyfriend. The hundreds of millions of people who follow her are aware of this disconnect and embrace the contrived aspect of her persona in a way that's more meta than classic Hollywood hero worship. It's something that Zamiri was grappling with while writing Kylie's scene in the moment. He wanted to take an experimental approach to her public image, her business, and explore how her identity has been warped, consumed, refracted, and reflected in the public eye. Kylie, obviously, on a personal level, is so grounded, so chill, but what she sort of represents is like an almost modern mythological figure, Zamiri says. That's why it was so interesting to have her in the film. It's almost like this was a Renaissance painting or something. We have Kylie as this amazing symbol of the world that we live in. Even before Hollywood took notice, Kylie's cultural impact was felt in fashion. In 2023, she showed up to the Schiaparelli show at Paris Fashion Week wearing a dress affixed with a lion's head designed by creative director Daniel Roseberry. First impression was that she was vibrating on a different frequency than the rest of the room, Roseberry tells me. I imagine her playing with her beauty like a producer in a recording studio. She's turning the bass up, the treble down, cranking the volume at this part, adding distortion in this moment. But whatever it is, it's drop-dead, dialed-in gorgeous. We're watching a woman at play with herself and her own image. Kylie, of course, is no regular model. She's a figure who can shift global markets just by wearing a dress. Her appearance in the lion's head dress generated $2.1 million in media impact value for Schiaparelli, according to brand analysis by Launch Metrics. I think Kylie is one of one, Chris says. Some people don't have the eye for being able to put things together a certain way, that artistic vision, and she's just got this level of creativity. A lot of us, just in my family, we just go to Kylie for a vision, an opinion. Even as a teenager, there was a dialogue between her and her fans, and her fans wanted to know what she was putting on her lips. Every other comment under my post, I remember, was like, "What shade are you wearing? What lip liner are you wearing?" she says. In order to get Kylie's full lip look, tweens would suck on glass bottles or shot glasses, often to the point of bruising. Kylie was dramatically overlining her lips and eventually admitted to getting temporary lip fillers, but that did nothing to stop her fans from clamoring to get any tips on how to make their lips look exactly like hers. And then came Kylie's eureka moment. She said, "I finally figured out what I want to do with the rest of my life," Chris recalls, "and I want you to figure out how to make it and manufacture it and get it done. But I know exactly what I want it to be and what I want it to look like and what I want the formula to feel like and be." Kylie tried to trademark her first name in 2014. Alas, the previous most famous Kylie, Kylie Minogue, blocked the effort. Undeterred, she started getting some funds together. "It was probably like half the money I had in my bank account. I just went for it," she says, recalling the $250,000. "My mom was like, 'You're going to be left with lots of lip kits in your garage if this doesn't work out.' And it wasn't even a thought that it wasn't going to work out." Chris wanted a traditional marketing strategy. Newspaper ads, TV spots, the works. But Kylie had other plans. "I remember telling my mom, 'No, I'm just going to post on my Instagram.'" Her instincts proved correct. "I remember watching how many people were waiting online for the launch. It was unbelievable," Chris says. "It was hundreds of thousands of people. You could see it in real time on our analytics system. The lip kits sold out almost instantly." Many accused the family of creating false scarcity in order to juice the hype. But that simply wasn't the case. The Oxnard factory, which was used to cranking out this kind of stuff, just couldn't physically make enough lip kits for the number of people who wanted them. "It wasn't very exciting for me for the first year because I was so stressed out that everyone would harass me on Twitter at the time because they couldn't get a lip kit," she says. "I couldn't handle it because I really wanted to just make everyone happy." Early on, Chris and Kylie had already begun talking about Kylie Cosmetics, as it became known, as a revolutionary company hell-bent on steering the market solely with the force of Kylie's generational influence. They teamed up with Shopify in January 2016 to handle distribution, allowing sales to fully go global. In just 18 months, the brand said it had done $420 million in sales. Based on the rapid demand and explosive growth of Kylie Cosmetics, the company drew the attention of the business press. Forbes put Kylie on its cover in August 2018 with the cover line "America's Women Billionaires," but noted inside that she wasn't a billionaire yet. They put her on the cover anyway because, well, she's Kylie. The following March, it happened. Forbes noted that with a company worth $900 million and $100 million in profit, Kylie had become the youngest ever self-made billionaire at just 21 years old, a younger age than even Mark Zuckerberg, who was 23 when he hit that mark. Later that year, Cody purchased a 51% stake in the company, a $600 million investment that allowed its purchaser to value the whole thing at $1.2 billion. When the magazine crunched Kylie's numbers again in 2020, taking into account the sale of her stake and the publicly traded Cody filings and stats, which appeared to show lower earnings than what the Jenners had forecast, they decided to lower the appellation. Kylie Jenner, even after pocketing an estimated $340 million after taxes from the sale, is not a billionaire, Forbes said. Regardless of whether she's locked down that third comma or not, the lip kits she launched on her Instagram were now part of an old-school conglomerate that included some of the world's most coveted cosmetics brands. The lip kit mania also coincided with Kylie becoming a mother, forcing her to juggle pregnancy and maternity along with the incessant branding of her, not just as a member of television's most famous family, but also as the model for what a Gen Z CEO can be. "Well, I got pregnant when I was 19. I had her when I was 20. Looking back on it, people are like, whoa," Kylie says. "They don't realize how young I was, maybe because I had already had this business and had been in the public eye for a while," I say. "In the world for so long," she says. A few years later, she had another child, a son, with her then-partner, the musician Travis Scott. She didn't hide her pregnancy like the first time, but was hardly transparent about the relationship's turbulence. Kylie broke up with Scott in the fall of 2019, spent quarantine with him to co-parent Stormy, recoupled in mid-2021, and welcomed Air in February 2022, all before breaking up for good around the holidays. Little of this would be chronicled on her social media feeds. Kylie took a page from the family playbook: distract, deny, and post something else. If all else fails, get off the gram altogether. In fact, several people contacted for this story declined to comment about her co-parenting situation with Scott or her relationship with Chalmay, perhaps somewhat prudent given their intense privacy and the omerta taken with the all-powerful Kardashian family. Kendall cited the lessons from watching Kim, Khloe, and Kourtney deal with their personal dramas growing up. "We learned how we wanted to take control of our private lives as much as we could," Kendall tells me. "But I've seen so much beautiful growth in her, and she's really come into herself in such an awesome way. She had kids really young, so she had to grow up quick. But it feels like the most adult I've ever seen her, and I feel like she's just really in her grown-up bag." When I spoke with her, Kendall also took a moment to note, wink, wink, nod, nod, that Kylie is very happy and grounded at the moment for some unspoken reason. "Over the course of this year, I had a small but potent squad of Kylie files asking me the same question, hoping I could get a definitive answer into the public ledger. Are Kylie and Timmy a real couple? Yes, they are. And besides the recent surge of PDA, maybe the most endearing sign of their shared affection is poker night. I grew up here, but I don't really have like a nightlife. I play a lot of poker," Kylie says. After our interview, she tells me she hosts poker nights at her house with Chalmay and his gang, a mix of Hollywood types and art world card sharks. She actually hosted everyone at her pad the night before I visited, but there were no lingering signs of degenerate gambling on the premises. I mentioned to Kylie that I had seen the most recent post on her Instagram story from the night before, a poker table with some chips on hand, a flop, some money. "Last night wasn't a good night for me," she says, and laughs. "Was the art gang there? Oh my God, I played with Jonas last night, and I think I'm going to go to his tournament," she says, referencing the painter Jonas Wood's annual World Series of Art poker event. For years, Wood has been running a game out of his studio, eventually welcoming all the heavy hitters in the L.A. art scene, as well as movie stars such as DiCaprio, Ellen DeGeneres, Jack Black, as well as Kylie and Chalamet. It is certainly the only place in the world where you can see Benny Blanco and Richard Prince anteing the same hand. I love playing with them because they bet big and they juice the pot, Kylie says. When you play a lot, to play with people who play it safe all the time sometimes isn't as fun. It's challenging because then they're betting big. Not to overextend the poker metaphor here, but it's kind of the best way to sum Kylie up. She made a career out of going all in. Regardless of whether she's a Nepo baby or self-made, you can't deny that she has always bet on herself. And after spending time with Kylie, I got a sense that despite her freewheeling charm, there isn't all that much left up to chance. Good luck on the poker table, Kylie tells me as I leave her house, the gate snapping open again, letting in the outside world, or at least the version of the real world that is high-status Los Angeles. The following weekend, the final 10 players in the World Series of Art Poker convened at a card table, set up at the living room, a super-private Hollywood members club, and Kylie was nowhere to be seen. After I left the poker table, I noticed Kylie had been Instagramming from home, right as the tournament was hurtling toward its big money ending, a tease for her new butter cake lip butter. A new Kylie Cosmetics product drop was a few days away. In Kylie world, it seems you make your own luck. The Man, The Metropolis, and the $720 million Museum. In the photos, Light in the Museum, Diego Rivera's Flower Day, Dia de Flores, is transported at LACMA as Govan looks on. For the last 20 years, LACMA director Michael Govan has faced off with billionaires and bureaucrats to reinvent the Encyclopedic Museum in Los Angeles, courtesy of a new building by Pritzker Prize winner Peter Zumthor. The city's museum snobs went on the attack, calling the design a small city airport terminal, the blob that ate Wilshire Boulevard, and a museum that benefits nobody. But Govan fought back, and next month he'll unveil the finished structure to the world. Before that, he gives Nate Freeman a sneak peek at the most important and controversial museum building in a generation. Photographer Max Farrago contributed to this article. Next photos, A Tall Order. Peter Zumthor, photographed by James Mollinson at Zumthor Studio in Switzerland, overlooking Wilshire Boulevard. The exterior of the museum. Conservators Ermano Carbonara, Corinne Claristefeld, Sara Chow, and Jessica Chasen. In the Atlantic section, Todd Gray smiles in front of his 27-foot-long piece, Octavia's Gaze. Associate conservator Julia Rioda, curator Sharon Takeda, and artist Sarah Rosalena, and scenes inside the museum. It is a sunny 75-degree day in mid-January, and Michael Govan, the CEO and director of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, is walking through a domed underpass at his brand-new building, the 347,500-square-foot David Geffen Galleries. It's an awesome responsibility to build a metropolitan-scale museum in the image of the 21st century, he says. Maybe in the 22nd century, it'll be like, oh, that was kind of 21st century. Perhaps the future is rosier to think about than the present. It is months before the public will set foot in the place, and the jury is still out on what all the fuss is about. Govan has spent all of his 2 decades as director trying to build a new structure that can house the biggest art collection west of the Mississippi. It was supposed to cost $650 million, but missed deadlines and overruns caused the budget to balloon to $720 million. The press was brutal. A local critic won a Pulitzer for a series of LA Times columns excoriating the vision and picking apart the follow-through. The public was bankrolling much of it via a Board of Supervisors decree to move taxpayer funds to the museum, but reacted to the design with a shrug at best. Plenty thought the undulated single-floor space looked like an amoeba oozing over Wilshire. It couldn't help that the architect Govan chose without a nominating contest was Peter Zumthor, who had never designed a building in America. In 2025, staff departures included the CFO and the COO. A few years earlier, billionaire Tom Gores, who owns a company that charges for phone calls made from prisons and faced accusations of price gouging, resigned his position on the board when activist groups spoke up. After voicing their concerns, the Amundsen Foundation decided to pull all future gifts to the museum, despite donating more than $130 million worth of art to LACMA over the years. It's my understanding that LACMA is changing from an encyclopedic museum with a robust permanent collection to a museum with some permanent collection works on view and more temporary exhibitions, William Amundsen told the New York Times in 2020. The concern is that the carefully curated collection we've amassed over decades may never see the light of day again. Govan's a museum savant. If anyone could overcome the odds, it was him. He was basically running the Williams College Museum of Art in his teens, helped the Guggenheim launch Frank Gehry's Bilbao building that shocked the world and turned post-industrial husk into art meccas at Mass, MoCA, and Dia Beacon. But in Tinseltown, Govan was fighting against the tide. Los Angeles is the nation's second biggest city, but art museums in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Boston, Houston, and San Francisco all regularly rack up more visitors than his fiefdom on Wilshire. Hollywood creates silver screen narratives adored by the world, but its institution for visual art was getting lapped by smaller cities. And so he dreamed up one of the largest public cultural spaces in Los Angeles, one that lets the landscape in and never lets the visitor forget that this museum is in this city. Even the Pritzker Prize winner Zumthor had his doubts. He could never imagine how the building would fit inside the limits of the La Brea tar pits, or how it would vault itself over Wilshire Boulevard. Once, while Govan was visiting the atelier, Zumthor took his arm and wiped an entire schematic to the floor in a fit of utter frustration. But again and again, Govan repeated to him, "This will be a masterpiece." This museum lets L.A. be present. The landscape and the houses and everything, Beverly Hills, the whole thing, is also present, Zumthor tells me. So they interact together. "We thought it's a beautiful idea. You experience this art, which comes from the whole world, in L.A., and not in a box." And now the David Geffen Galleries, so named for the $150 million gift from the billionaire philanthropist, is here, and Govan is ready to defend it wholesale. Just its physical presence is something of a justification. Actually walking through it with him, the imposing concrete, seemingly carved out of a mountain, is a touch surreal. And that is before he tells me it moves, as in the entire gigantic museum is built on base isolators that allow it to swing 5 feet in any direction. If it can't move, it can't absorb the earthquakes that will inevitably rock this weather-beaten city into the perilous decades of climate change to come. It's as heavy as an NFL stadium, or the combined weight of every palm tree in Los Angeles. It already looks like it's been there forever, some gnomic ruin from prehistoric La La Land, newly dredged up from the bottom of the tar pits. And yet, it's a museum so Mariana Trench-proof, it could, as Govan implies, last for centuries. "There's this idea that you're kind of making an investment," he says. "What Peter and I did, we wanted it to feel like a little bit ancient, like it had been here a long time. And with the seismic engineering, maybe it will be the oldest building in L.A. at some point, because over time, you never know." When LACMA's David Geffen Galleries open to the public next month, it will mark the completion of one of the country's most ambitious cultural projects in its history. There will be galas, dinners, concerts, and a ribbon cutting with all the local political bigwigs. The galleries will be in on the bash, too. Jeffrey Deitch's Hollywood Gallery will contain an iconic modern sculpture, Charles Ray's 46-foot-long painted aluminum fire truck, for the first time since it was on view in front of LACMA 18 years ago. The museum's incredible holdings, Rembrandts, Impressionist treasures, thousands of pre-Columbian wonders, will be on view again after years in storage or on loan. Even in a city that hosts globally important award shows nearly every weekend in the winter, the April opening is going to stand out. The county will be very involved, and it better be, as it appropriated $125 million of taxpayer money to the project, happily. What better place than L.A., where dreams are made and come true, that through this public-private partnership, we were able to pull it off, says Supervisor Holly Mitchell, who represents the 2nd District of Los Angeles County, and is a deeply influential figure in local politics. between LACMA, between Disney Concert Hall, between the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, L.A. County has a rich history of being directly involved in the construction of cultural venues. But in some ways, Govan views the spread on Wilshire as something more than just a big new place to see art in L.A. He spent his life making museums. What if he could make something that's more than a museum? What if it could be the anchor presence of a multi-tendrilled 21st century global soft power entity? Over the last decade, I've watched Govan work the art world room by room, continent by continent, in his quest to make the museum into one of the world's powerhouse art platforms. He's that rarest of breeds, an institutional administrator who actually went to art school to train as an artist, and he's a wickedly talented networker, a one-man LACMA cheerleader in a natty suit, fully at ease at, to use two late 2025 scenes where we were both present, a dinner at Maxim's in Paris, hosted by Miuccia Prada, or a cocktail party for the LACMA Young Donor Circle at Art Basel Miami Beach. He can fundraise like nobody else, soliciting eye-watering chunks of change from the world's wealthiest cultural benefactors. Geffen gave $150 million. Elaine Wynn gave $50 million. In February, he was in Doha for the inaugural Art Basel Qatar, alongside Sheikha Almayassa, whom Govan's been working with since a partnership was announced in 2019. They're big partners and friends, he tells me, and is constantly in Las Vegas to check on the city's first dedicated contemporary art museum, which LACMA is supporting through a share of its collection. He's also made some monumental entreaties to Asia, most significantly through a partnership with the Yuz Museum. For years, LACMA threw an over-the-top bash during Art Basel Hong Kong, including one on a three-story, 260-foot boat called Jumbo Kingdom that featured cinematic licentiousness on each floor. I was there perilously on board that gigantic floating restaurant, watching as a single West Coast museum put its firm stamp on Hong Kong. "Can a party change the world?" asked Tatler. Speaking of parties changing the world, the first major event held at LACMA's new edition will be the Vanity Fair Oscar Party, Hollywood's biggest celebration of the year, relocating to the museum's grounds. Govan, ever the showman, giddily swings me under concrete cathedrals, where the main nave of the event will be, into a glass-walled convex orb, where the traditional post-Oscars In-N-Out burgers will be served. "We can do outdoor movies, concerts. We'll do an art festival here. The Calder sculpture is going to be over there, under those lights, with the jets of water," Govan says, his fingers pointing this way and that, up and down, walking around this insane museum yet to be seen by Angelenos. Shio Kusaka has a spaceship, a flying saucer, that's beyond the education space, so the idea is it's a garden of follies. He points to the light shining down on the letters affixed to the rim of the building, spelling out David Geffen Galleries, and casting big shadows on the floor. The ever-present sun setting in cloudless L.A. makes the giant shadow letters as constant as the Pacific Ocean tides. Suddenly, $150 million doesn't seem like too much to pay. "I sent David a picture of that," Govan says. "In terms the local industry can get behind, LACMA isn't the MacGuffin, it's the main character." Zumthor's addition has been held up as the raison d'etre for the town's expanded gallery network that saw Outpost from David Zwirner, Hauser & Wirth, and Marion Goodman open since the pandemic. It's been tracked by the culture department of the Los Angeles Times as a permanent beat, with special attention paid to the ballooning cost. It's been a veritable punching bag for the literati of Los Angeles, with the Times' Christopher Knight scoring a Pulitzer Prize for work demonstrating extraordinary community service by a critic, applying his expertise and enterprise to critique a proposed overhaul of the L.A. County Museum of Art. In the Los Angeles Review of Books, Joseph Giovannini called the design an amoebic pancake and came up with a super subtle headline for a series of articles about the new LACMA, Suicide by Architecture. For a town that snaps open the trades every morning to read reviews, well, the reviews weren't great. The blob that ate Wilshire Boulevard, wrote the Architectural Record. The Incredible Shrinking Museum, wrote Knight in the Times. Where once we had sci-fi, now we have an agreeable cream-colored concrete structure that in at least one schematic, the northward-facing view from Wilshire, bears the profile of a small city airport terminal, wrote Carolina Miranda, also in the Times. The clunky, amoeba-like building cannot seem to decide between the digitally derived expressionism of such architects as Frank Gehry or Zaha Hadid and Zumthor's own brand of minimalist modernism. We're left with a museum that benefits nobody, wrote Kate Wagner in the New Republic. Much of the controversy over Zumthor's radical design concerns the demolition of several original structures. Years before the building even took shape, the dialogue scripted a narrative where those suggesting teardowns were inflicting some cancer upon the urban landscape. But those unfamiliar with Govan don't fully understand that he's done that sort of thing already. In his 20s, he helped Thomas Krenz convert a former textile mill in North Adams, Massachusetts, into what eventually became Mass Mocha in 1999. When he was just 35, he was flying a small rented plane. Yes, Govan can fly airplanes and personally takes board members in L.A. to see the land art in New Mexico, up the Hudson River, when he saw a large structure just outside the town of Beacon, New York. It was once a Nabisco factory. Midair, Govan dreamed up a temple to minimalism called Dia Beacon. So he's built museums before. What he's been working toward with LACMA the last two decades is something way more ambitious, Fitzcarraldo-esque even. He's building the world's last encyclopedic museum and intends it to last for centuries. When the question came up about this place, it was, did the world need a reconsidered whole art history? And you have to think it's a rare thing, Govan tells me, as we make our way upstairs to the glass-walled atria where art will soon be installed. The only places that have encyclopedic museums are in the United States. In the 19th century, they assembled old buildings in Paris and London and other places in Berlin. But this animal, it's a weird American thing, and there won't be any more. And there are none you can tear down. The only one you could reshape was L.A. So it was a once-in-a-not-in-a-lifetime. It was a once-in-a-world history opportunity, to be fair. The relentless pearl-clutching, the pulled loans, the Pulitzer for architectural philistinism, the unceasing drumbeat of doomsayers missed the most controversial aspect of the project. Govan, through sheer force of will, has decided to rip up the entire idea of what a museum can be. All of us, academically and in curatorial practice, were like, yeah, we love museums. Museums are cool. But all those museums were formed in a 19th century image, and it's been a few years, he says. So what the world really needs is a reconsidered encyclopedic museum. And I knew what it was. It was no hierarchies among cultures. It wasn't a Greco-Roman pediment over a temple. It looked like L.A. And so this idea of no hierarchies, that was the idea. I was like, oh my God, we could do that now. The legacy of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, relative to its peers, is short. It was only established in the early 1960s, and when it first opened, was the largest new art museum built in the U.S. after the National Gallery of Art. William Randolph Hearst was an early supporter, and the initial loans trickled in from J. Paul Getty before he decided to open a museum next to his house in Pacific Palisades, now the Getty Villa. By the 1990s, the museum was fighting for relevance even within its own city. As the artist-founded Mocha, co-founded by mega philanthropist Eli Broad, scored a series of hits with shows such as Helter Skelter, a survey of California artists that was instantly star-making, and in the decades that followed, utterly canonical. In the 90s, director Andrea Rich tried to recruit a then 33-year-old Govan, newly installed at the top perch at DIA, to join the museum, but he rebuffed the offer. He wasn't sure that Los Angeles was a town for ambitious artists, the types of people who could support a thriving art ecosystem. He recalled what the artist John Baldessari said to his students around the time Govan was a graduate student at the University of California, San Diego, a decade earlier. After graduating from one of L.A.'s much ballyhooed elite art schools, it was time to leave for a place where art was actually appreciated, namely New York. By the time Govan was recruited to come to LACMA in the early 2000s, he checked back with Baldessari. The artist had changed his tune. Los Angeles, he had decided, was a place where artists could actually live. Yeah, he told them to stay. He always told them to go to New York, and he would say this, and then there was a moment where he said, no, just stay, Govan recalls. You don't have to go to New York. And so Govan arrived in Los Angeles. As a brash East Coast transplant, he brought with him bona fides in iconoclastic spaces and an air of youth. He was in his early 40s, pretty young for an art museum director. He immediately started to reinvent the span of Miracle Mile that had been bequeathed to him. In 2008, the Broad Contemporary Art Museum opened in a new building by Renzo Piano, the first in a series of stages all designed by Piano, the Pritzker Prize winner, most famous for building the Pompidou with Richard Rogers. Govan not only moved on from future design plans, he made it clear that the 1960s buildings would have to be demolished, and he was not coy about this. I literally came to LACMA to tear the whole thing down, he told the New Yorker in 2020, as he was tearing it down. Right off the bat, Govan offered the building to Zumfor, the lauded minimalist architect who had never designed a building in America. No competition, no tryouts, no picking by committee. This was fully Govan's choice, and Los Angeles had to embrace it. I learned about him when I was working with him at DIA, and had no idea I would be here, Govan tells me, explaining that Zumthor had come up with a plan for a pavilion of Walter de Maria works that was never completed. So he described this experience in Los Angeles and the American artist he was interested in. I was like, yeah, why hasn't he built a building in the U.S.? For Zumthor, the proposal was a bit of a shock. All of a sudden, he called as a surprise, and then he came to the point and said, I'm about to accept the position in Los Angeles to be the director of this museum there. And there, I have to build a new building, and I think you should be the architect for the new building, Zumthor recalls, over an extremely picturesque Zoom from his offices in the Swiss town of Haldenstein in the Alps. It sounded a bit like, I'm only going there if you're agreeing to be the architect. Zumthor accepted, and Govan accepted. In due time, the architect came up with an undulating, single-story blob that people hated. And then there was the glass. The architect loved the flora and fauna of the city and wanted to bring it into the museum, which is not typical of your encyclopedic mausoleums to culture, walled off from the outside world. I never imagined Peter would be this radical, Govan says, as the sheer intensity of that much glass dawns on us, walking through the space. He's like, yeah, okay, then we're doing windows all the way around. I was like, you can't do windows, can you? And we worked it out. But it's just a super radical idea, right? For Zumthor, who collaborated with the firm of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the process was buttressed by a mutual trust and the freedom to pursue his vision to its full extent. He knows how to deal with artists and with architects. He takes architects as artists, Zumthor says. He criticizes them and so on and said this and that. But this, he told me from the beginning, it's going to be your thing. You will sign the work, and I will not have the last word. And he kept that for many years. Criticism is subjective, but the numbers don't lie. Scraping together the funds was always going to be a massive undertaking. Board co-chair Willow Bay, the dean of the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, has been a trustee since 2007, shortly after Govan stepped in as director. Once Govan brought in his plan for Zumthor to completely rethink the museum campus, the board snapped into action. The first step wasn't asking for money. It was making sure that the idea was strong enough, powerful enough, to deserve a campaign of this scale, says Bay, who for years has funded the maintenance of Chris Burden's Urban Light, along with her husband, Disney CEO Bob Iger. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can just ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.